is Monday, May 11th, and welcome to Career 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Seoul has concluded that two unidentified aerial objects struck the South Korean-operated HMM Namu in the Strait of Hormuz, causing last week's explosion and fire. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we'll preview the 2026 FIFA World Cup, now just 30 days away, with a look at South Korea's 11th straight appearance, Korea's Group A chances, and the favourites to lift the trophy. And in lieu of sports roundup, we'll continue the football theme with Paju Frontier FC, the first Korean club to rise from the 5th Division to K-League 2, and speak with head coach Gerard News. Let's start Korea 24 right now. Seoul's foreign ministry says two aerial objects struck the HMM Namu last week, causing an explosion and a fire. The ministry disclosed the findings on Sunday after a multi-agency investigation to determine what exactly happened to the South Korean-operated ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Our KBS World Radio news reporter Bae Joon joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Joon.
Hello, Alana.
So South Korean investigators have concluded that an attack on the stern of the HMM Namu caused the explosion on the vessel last week. Tell us more about that.
Foreign Ministry spokesperson Park Il briefed reporters on the findings on Sunday, saying two aerial objects were captured by the ship's surveillance camera. This is what he said.
정밀한 현장 조사, CCTV 확인 및
Based on a detailed on-site investigation, surveillance camera footage, and interviews with the captain, it was confirmed that at around 3:30 p.m. local time on May 4, two unidentifiable aerial objects struck the outer plating of the port side stern ballast tank of the HMM Namu about a minute apart. The impact caused flames and smoke accompanied by vibrations.
타격으로 인한 충격 후 진동을 동반한
The ministry released photos of the 38,000-ton cargo ship with the port side of its stern torn open, revealing the damage 5 meters wide and 7 meters deep. Let's hear more from the ministry spokesperson.
CCTV 영상에서 해당 비행체가 포착되었으나
The aerial objects in question were captured on the surveillance camera footage, but there are limitations in confirming the entity that launched it, the exact model, and its physical dimensions. We plan to conduct further analysis of the engine debris recovered from the site.
While Seoul is opting not to draw any conclusions on who was behind the attack, Iranian ambassador to South Korea Saeed Kuzechi was seen entering the foreign ministry just before the briefing Sunday.
And Joon, do we know why the ambassador made that visit?
Asked why Kuzechi was there, the South Korean spokesperson said the government wanted to share its findings with the envoy. Meanwhile, as the strategic Strait of Hormuz remains closed, the government says it is closely reviewing participation in the U.S.-led Freedom of the Seas initiative.
Well, the presidential office has condemned last week's attack on that cargo ship operated by a South Korean company.
Yeah, National Security Advisor Wee Sung-nak unveiled a stance on Monday in a press conference decrying the strikes on the HMM Namu as an act of aggression against a civilian vessel. Saying such unjustified attacks cannot be tolerated, Wee said that further investigation is needed to determine the exact nature of the two objects that struck the ship and who launched them. He said it is unlikely that a mine or torpedo was involved considering the pattern of the damage. While making clear that attacks against civilian vessels cannot be tolerated, a senior official at the top office said, it's too soon to definitively attribute the attack to any particular country.
And Joon, has there been any response from the Iranian government on the probe findings regarding the HMM Namu?
No, it has remained virtually silent on the matter. Responding to a KBS inquiry, the Iranian embassy said Monday that it has no official position on Seoul's findings or on its earlier denial of Iranian involvement. Iran's English-language state media outlet Press TV has also remained silent, despite earlier comments that virtually acknowledged the incident and suggested the Iranian military attacked the South Korean vessel for violating its new maritime rules for the strait.
Well, while staying mum on the matter of the Korean ship, the Iranian government has moved to further raise tensions in the region.
Yes, Alana, the Iranian Navy said it deployed homegrown light submarines known as Dolphins of the Persian Gulf in the strategic waterway to confront hostile naval vessels and demonstrate the country's maritime defensive power. Reuters quoted Fars News Agency as saying that the head of Iran's armed forces, Ali Abdullahi, also met with Iran's supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, and received from him a new guiding measures to pursue military operations and firmly confront adversaries. Another cargo vessel in the Gulf was also attacked on Sunday, about 40 kilometers northeast of Doha, the capital of Qatar. Analysts view Iran's aggressive actions as a high-leverage strategy to force concessions from the U.S. in ongoing negotiations.
Meanwhile, in a response to the United States' latest plan to end the war, Tehran offered a counter-proposal asking for compensation and recognition of its sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz, among other things. However, I understand U.S. President Donald Trump was not happy with that counter-proposal.
That's correct. Trump said the demands were totally unacceptable. In an interview with an American TV show that also aired Sunday, Trump said Iran has been defeated, but the war is not over, adding that the U.S. could go in for two more weeks and hit other targets in Iran.
Now, later this week, Trump is set to embark on his first state visit to China since 2017. When will he hold summit talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping?
That would be Thursday. In a press briefing Sunday, White House Deputy Press Secretary Anna Kelly said Trump is scheduled to land in Beijing on Wednesday evening and meet with the Chinese leader the following day. The Deputy Press Secretary said the two leaders are expected to discuss creating a new board of trade to keep their countries talking on economic issues and enhancing cooperation in energy, aerospace, and agriculture. She also said Trump and Xi will look around Beijing's Tiantan Park before attending a state dinner. The park is a religious complex dating back to the 15th century, also known as the Temple of Heaven.
And ahead of that summit on Thursday, I understand that high-level envoys from the United States and China are set to hold last-minute negotiations here in South Korea.
Yes, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent announced on X on Sunday that he planned to depart Monday for a quick series of meetings in both Japan and South Korea ahead of the Trump-Xi summit. Bessent will make a stop in Seoul on Wednesday after talks with Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng before heading to Beijing to accompany Trump on his state visit to China. No details were revealed about the possibility of a meeting between Bessent and his South Korean counterpart, Finance Minister Koo Yoon-chul, during his visit to Seoul.
Well, in other headlines, the benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index surpassed the 7,800 mark for the first time on Monday on the back of major tech stocks. Ji-yeon, tell us more.
The KOSPI began the day on a high note and finished it on a higher note. The benchmark gauge pierced the 7,800 mark early in the session, rising by more than 5% at one point and almost reaching the 7,900 mark. As trading heated up, a buy-side sidecar was activated during intraday trading, marking Monday the eighth day this year the mechanism has been triggered. The index rose 324.24 points, or 4.32%, to close at 7,822.24.
Also on Monday, the combined market capitalization of listed companies exceeded the 7 quadrillion won mark for the first time.
Yes, the gains were partly driven by surges in tech stocks in New York, which drove purchases of South Korean memory shares. Individual investors and institutions were net buyers, acquiring 3.5 trillion won worth of shares. Foreign investors also were net buyers, acquiring a similar amount of shares. SK Hynix rose by more than 11%, reaching 1,888,000 won per share, while Samsung Electronics jumped 6.33% to 285,500 won.
And staying on economic news, exports during the first 10 days of May reached a new high despite the war in Iran, thanks to the continued upswing in semiconductor shipments. Jun, give us the details there.
According to provisional data from the Korea Customs Service released on Monday, exports jumped 43.7% from a year earlier to stand at $18.4 billion between May 1st and 10th. Shipments of semiconductors jumped 149.8% to $8.5 billion, increasing their share of total exports to 46.3%.
And what did imports look like during that same 10-day period?
Imports grew 14.9% to $16.7 billion. In particular, imports of crude oil, gas, and coal grew 8.9%, largely due to a weak Korean won and surge in global oil prices. While exports exceeding imports, the nation posted a trade surplus of $1.7 billion.
And for our final story, the government will begin its second round of payouts next week to mitigate harm to the public amid soaring global oil prices stemming from the crisis in the Middle East. Now, this assistance will be handed out to the bottom 70% of income earners. Ji-yeon, just how many people is this?
approximately 36 million people will be eligible for these handouts, payouts based on household national health insurance contributions as of March 2026. Take note that the first round was distributed to single parents, people near the poverty line, and recipients of basic social assistance benefits. Relevant ministries announced the details Monday, saying the payouts will range from 100,000 won, or around $68, to 250,000 won per person, with amounts at the higher end of the range allocated for those residing outside the capital area or in regions with population decline. Households with family members whose aggregate property tax base surpassed 1.2 billion won in 2025 or whose total financial income exceeded 20 million won in 2024 will be excluded, with the total number of people excluded estimated at 2.5 million.
And until when will these applications be accepted?
Until July 3rd, both on and offline. The assistance can take the form of prepaid cards, regional gift certificates, or credit via recipients' credit cards, and will be valid through August 31st.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Gian, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
This is documentary director Lee Jin-young. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The countdown is officially on. The 2026 FIFA World Cup is now just 30 days away, and this will be the biggest edition in the tournament's history. For the first time, 48 teams will compete, and in another first, the World Cup will be co-hosted by three countries: the United States, Mexico, and Canada. South Korea will be there for an 11th consecutive World Cup, opening its campaign against Czechia in Guadalajara on June 12th Korea time. So, what should we expect from Hong Myung-bo's side? Can Korea make another run to the knockout stage? And who will be lifting the trophy in New Jersey on July 19th? To break it all down, I'm joined today by two guests. First, here in the studio, we have our regular sports roundup contributor, Yuji Ho of Yonhap News Agency. Great to have you with us, Jiho.
Yes, yeah, great to be here.
And on the line from England, we have John Dorden of The Guardian and BBC. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Dorden.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into Korea's chances, let's start with, you know, just the sheer scale of this tournament, because the World Cup this year is literally going to be spread across an entire continent. Jiho, let's first talk about the significance of this World Cup. And of course, what does it mean for South Korea and some of the South Korean players?
Sure. Well, you just touched upon the sheer size of this year's tournament, the first one to have three co-host countries. With 48 nations up from 32 from 32 from previous editions of this tournament, you know, it's going to be a lot of traveling, not only for the players and the teams, but also the fans of these national teams who will be making their ways to North America to watch their national teams play. Now, with South Korea obviously playing in their 11th consecutive World Cup, number 12 overall, that streak actually began back in 1986 in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're going back to the country, having ended up in the same group with Mexico, along with Czechia and South Africa. South Korea will play all three group stage matches in Mexico, including two in Guadalajara, the same city. So, you know, that's sort of lessened the travel burden on the Korean team compared to maybe some of the other countries, even within the same group. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the factors I think that will be working in favor of the Korean team at this year's World Cup. So there's a lot to look forward to, obviously, with the you know, the scale of this tournament, the number of countries being involved, number of confederations being represented. It's going to be a pretty exciting summer for football fans out there.
Absolutely. Certainly a lot to look forward to. Now, South Korea opens Group A against Czechia in Guadalajara on June 12th Korea time. Then, as you mentioned, yeah, they're going to be facing Mexico at the same stadium a week later before wrapping up against South Africa in Monterrey. So looking at that schedule, Jiho, what should Korea's kind of, you know, game plan be? What matches are must wins? And what can they afford, if where can they afford, if anywhere, to maybe drop points?
Yeah, so if you look at, just on paper, go by the FIFA rankings right now. Korea number 25, Mexico 15, Czechia 40, 41st, and South Africa number 60. So maybe you go by that. You know, I'm a little hesitant to say this is an easy group, because there's really no such a thing as an easy group in World Cup, I believe. Might be cliche. But this is, I would say, one of the softer groups for teams to play out of. And, you know, Korea might be looking at Czechia and South Africa, maybe the two beatable teams. And I'm thinking those two nations will look at Korea and say, hey, this is a beatable team in this group. With Mexico being the home team, the highest ranked team in this group, they might be the favorite to win it. And then I think three other teams might be, you know, saying to themselves, hey, we're going to be all battling for second place behind Mexico. So, I think the first match is always very important. And for Korea to go up against Czechia in the first match, I think you got to win that one to really set the tone for the rest of the tournament. And, you know, I'm predicting that Korea might have some issues against sort of the defensive-oriented approach of the Czechia team. Because, you know, knowing they're going to be the underdog, Czechia might be content to settle for a draw and really knock things down on their own end. And Korea might have some trouble breaking through that. But if Korea somehow managed to win that first match, get 3 points early, I think it's going to set the tone for the rest of the way. And, you know, they might be able to, like you said, may be able to afford to lose points against, not win any points against Mexico, but they've got South Africa, the lowest ranked team, coming up in the final group match. So, you know, if you win the first one, kind of feel good about yourself. Might lose the next one, but you know what? You got another potentially winnable match coming up. So you're looking at, you know, optimistically, maybe two wins out of the three for Team Korea if they kind of get off on the right foot.
So really, as you said, Jiho, that first match could be, you know, critical with setting the tone and kind of getting the momentum going. Mr. Durden, what's your take on that kind of Group A matchup? Again, we've got Czechia, South Korea, Mexico and South Africa.
Yeah, as Jiho said, it's an open group, and if you offered this group to the Koreans before the draw was made, they definitely would have been quite happy, would have taken it. I agree, the first game is always very important, especially this time. I think Czechia is a team that Korea should be looking to win. One, I think, perhaps benefit of the location being played in Mexico, the conditions should suit the Koreans a bit better than the Czechs. I mean, Korean players grew up in playing in hot and humid conditions at home. The Czechs do not. So that should, I think, play a small part. But also, the team hasn't been going so well, of course, of late. There are some issues and doubts. But it means expectations perhaps are a bit lower. Pressure might be a bit less. But of course, in the opening game, you've got to be looking to get 3 points because, as Joe said, the second game is against Mexico, and you don't want to be in a situation where you go to play Mexico in Mexico and you have to win. Then you're in a situation you don't want to be in. But yeah, it's an open group, and if Korea play well against the Czechs, they have what it takes to win, because as European teams go, it's one of the weaker ones. They didn't impress in qualification. They even lost to the Faroe Islands in qualification, which was quite a shock. They came through the playoffs. So I think the time when this Korean team was a bit wary of European teams has gone. So there should be some, hopefully, confidence going into that we can, you know, take the game to the Czechs and get the 3 points. And with this, with the format of the tournament, wherein, you know, 32 of the teams of the 48 will go through to the next round, then 3 or 4 points will probably be enough. Then get 3 points in your first game, then you've got a lot of breathing space going into final two games.
So again, that first game, potentially absolutely critical for Team Korea. Let's talk a little bit more about the team. Head coach Hong Myung-bo is set to name his squad on May 16th before the team, of course, flies to Salt Lake City on May 18th for some altitude training. Ji-ho, how would you assess the state of this squad right now, and how have the team been performing as of late?
Yes, John, I think, just touched upon how the expectations on the team right now might be a little low. And I think the fans' collective confidence level, you know, quite possibly might be at an all-time low during any recent sort of World Cup cycle. Just looking at the last two matches that Korea played, losing to Ivory Coast 4-0 and Austria 1-0 in a couple of away friendly matches in Europe, did not exactly instill confidence in the fan base, who hadn't been happy with the team, the way the team played late last year. You know, talking about Hong Myung-bo, he was not a very, very popular hiring when he was when he took over for the second time back in the summer of 2024. You know, he got booed at home. The team, you know, ended up not being able to beat some of the underdogs during the Asian qualification. Things kind of started getting piled up a little bit. You know, not being able to beat teams like Palestine. You know, even in some of the wins that they did manage, did not look very convincing in doing that. So, again, I think the expectations are relatively low at this point. But I guess we'll see. You know, they're going to be having this training camp out in Salt Lake City in Utah. Like you said, some of the altitude training, because they're going to be playing some matches in high altitude in Mexico. So they're going to be out there about 4 or 5, 6 weeks and play a couple of matches as well. You know, some people might say they're going to be spending too much time together. The players might get sick of each other by the time the tournament begins. But, you know, I think it's always better to, just because Korean players are not mostly used to playing in these conditions, whereas high altitude might run out of oxygen, you know, after about 10, 15 minutes. So I think it's going to help them to have the kind of training ahead of time. But based on the recent results, and not just the outcomes, but also the way they played in those losses, and also even some of the wins, just have not given their fans much to cheer about in recent months.
I mean, I remember really clearly discussing those friendlies, and especially against Ivory Coast, how disappointing that result was for fans and for the squad. But Mr. Durden, as you just said, perhaps going into this with some low expectations might not be the worst thing.
Yeah, I think it could work both ways, of course. It's nice to have a bit of realism. There's always surprises come up during the World Cup as well. We should always remember that the other three teams have issues of their own. This is always the case. This doesn't operate in a vacuum. But I think the altitude is very interesting, because I remember the 2010 World Cup in Johannesburg in South Africa. That's a similar level of, I think, almost 2,000 metres above sea level as Guadalajara. And some teams have problems with that. And it's a bit fortunate also that means the South African team have much more experience at altitude than Korea, but Korea play South Africa in a different seat that's much lower down, so that shouldn't be an issue. And I think it's good, you know, the altitude thing can be a significant factor in football, as we see, you know, Bolivia always win at home in the World Cup qualifiers because they're like 3,000, 4,000 metres above sea level, do badly away. So if they can get acclimatised very well, it could be a big plus, especially if, you know, the Czechs maybe in the European season don't have quite as much time. So these things, you know, have to be done. Of course, there's lots of the factors at play. Injuries, of course, comes into it, and, you know, the tactical acumen of the coach, which maybe we'll touch upon. And there's lots of the factors, but yeah, I mean, low expectations, it means, you know, the players at least know what they have to do. And as we said, can't have a bad start, but then things can fall apart quite quickly.
Well, let's talk about tactics a little bit more. Ji-ho, judging from the latest form, what kind of tactical decisions are you keeping an eye out for? And, you know, what does the spine look like? What will the starting lineups be, essentially?
Yeah, so Coach Hong has been kind of, you know, tinkering with the back three formation since July last year, really, at the East Asian Football Federation Championship at home. Before that, before he took over, and I guess in the early days of his second stint with the national team, they usually, well, I mean, almost always use the four defenders on the back line. But they've been using mostly three center backs, flanked by wing backs on either side. You know, those guys will, you know, they're kind of responsible for pushing forward when they have the ball and coming back, recover back to create a back line of five when they don't have the ball. And they've had some mixed results. You know, they looked really good against the U.S., beating them 2-0 in U.S. last September. But then again, Brazil just took them to school, beating them 5-0 at home. And the score really flattered Korea, actually. They could have lost by a lot more. So it's been a sort of mixed bag since they've been playing this system. So, you know, for me, I think a lot of people will be kind of looking at how they're going to be, how efficient they're going to be within this with that system with three center backs and the wing backs on either side. And, you know, some of the individual players, I think there are some injury concerns right now, especially with the midfielder Hwang In-bum, who's one of the key players, as irreplaceable as anybody on this team, including guys like Son Heung-min and Lee Kang-in, really, just because of the way he can kind of, you know, control the match in both ways, whether it's defending, whether it's creating offensive chances. He's got an ankle injury that he suffered while playing for his Dutch team, Feyenoord. He's working out, he's rehabbing with the national team staff in Korea so that he will be ready to hopefully contribute to the national team in the World Cup. He got hurt in March. They ruled him out for the rest of the European season. They're hoping that he's going to be ready by June for the tournament. But if he's not available or if he's not 100%, you know, I think that spells some trouble because Korea's not just in his position, but some of the other positions, they don't really have a lot of depth behind those mainstays. Mm-hmm. For example, if Son Heung-min, let's say, knock on wood, if something happens to him, he gets hurt, who's going to take his spot on the lineup? Or Lee Kang-in, if he's not 100%, who's going to, you know, step up and, you know, play that role? I think the gap between the mainstays, the regulars, and the reserves is a little bit larger for Korea, maybe compared to other some of the top dogs in the tournament. So I think they might come back to bite them if anything happens to some of the key players.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked kind of more broadly about South Korea's chances and some of the external factors at play, like the altitude and like home fans and injuries. But I want to ask a bit more about specifics. Mr. Durden, looking at Korea from the outside, where do you think in particular the team might do well at the World Cup level? And conversely, where do you think Hong sides, you know, could be quite vulnerable?
Well, going forward, I mean, Korea can play with speed and precision. You know, how much that, if getting the first game against the Czechs, you know, I think Chihon mentioned, you probably expect the European team to be a bit conservative and sit back and look to hit on the break with set pieces. And in the past, Korea's had problems in, you know, breaking such teams down. And there's experience in the team as well, big game experience. Some of these players have played at World Cups before. Son, this is his fourth World Cup. You have, you know, star players like Lee Kang-in and Kim Min-jae who play for top. I mean, the best club teams in the world, even though they don't always, you know, get on the, not always part of the first team. They do play enough that these are kind of elite level players. So the spine of the Korean team, if Hwang In-bum is fit, you know, it looks pretty decent. I think as Gio mentioned, you know, there is a gap between, you know, those top players and the rest. There's enough, I think, skill and ability and creativity when Lee Kang-in's on the ball and Hwang In-bum's there to cause problems for any team. And the fitness level should be pretty good too with the preparations that they're going to have. I think the uncertainty for me, the one problem is, as Gio touched upon, is, you know, the coach Hong said there's been 3-man defence, 4-man defence, and in March after friendlies he said he's still not decided, which I think is a big cause for concern, really. So close to the tournament. If he doesn't really know what his best team is, what his best formation is, I think this could become a serious problem. If you have a set way you want to play and the team that you know you really want to have, and then you're fine-tuning, experimenting close before the World Cup, that's one thing. But if you don't really know your favourite formation, I think that is going to be, is potentially, you know, going to be a huge problem. And as I said, it all depends on a good start. But if he can get the tactics out, if he can get the team playing the way he wants, then of course it could be a decent World Cup. We can define what a decent World Cup means in a 48-team competition, which I think changed. The expansion of the competition changes what success looks like. Mm-hmm. But to talk about vulnerabilities, I think defensively against Ivory Coast, you know, they looked all over the place at the back and lots of space for the attackers. And if they play like that at the World Cup, then it's going to be a very short stay in Mexico, I think.
Right, well, speaking of success, I'm going to put you both on the spot now. Mr. Durden, I'll start with you. Will Korea reach the round of 16? And how many points do you think that they may take away from the three group stages?
Well, as I mentioned, it's changed because in the past you could say quite clearly, 32-team World Cup, you know, group of four, finish in the top two, then you go through to the round of 16. And in Korea, that was always the benchmark of success. Mm-hmm. If you get through, rightly or wrongly, and I think sometimes wrongly, but if you get through, it doesn't matter how you played, what happened, get to round of 16, the World Cup's been successful. If you get past that, that'll be a huge bonus. But now, you know, 32 teams go to the knockout stage. And so, if not part of the round of 32, that's going to be a total disaster for in World Cup terms. But then, being one of the 32, then it depends on who Korea could play in that round. So I think getting to round of 32 could be a little bit ambiguous. But if they can get to round of 16 of a 48-team World Cup, then that would be a successful World Cup. I don't think they will. I think round of 32 is probably as far as they will go because it's such an open group. There's so many uncertainties. But I think 4 points, no. 4 points is often enough in a 32-team World Cup to get through, and it'll be enough in a 48-team. You get 4 points, a win and a draw, then you'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. Jihyo, let's get your verdict. Are Korea going to make it to the round of 16, and what's your points prediction?
Okay, I'm taking 3 points. Three draws. Three draws in the group stage. Korea's going to sneak into the round of 32 because, you know, out of 48, 32, it's hard not to make a top of, you know, round of 32 with the kind of team that Korea has right now, even with all these issues I just mentioned earlier. So I'm saying they're going to be third in the group, but somehow sneak into the round of 32, and that's where I think their tournament will end.
Okay. And sorry.
Three points in round of 32, but no round of 16 for Korea.
Okay.
That's my call.
Well, now let's turn to the trophy itself. Only 8 nations have ever won the World Cup: Brazil, Germany, Italy, Argentina, France, Uruguay, England and Spain. This time the bookmakers have Spain and France leading the pack. England's not too far behind. Mr. Durden, let me come to you first. How do you see the top tier contenders? And is there a clear favourite or do you think it's still wide open?
Well, for me, I think France are the best team, have the best players, and also in depth. In those terms, they should win. We should also mention, I think the conditions, I think, may not suit the European teams very well. I mean, it's going to be very hot in times, humid. And it's come at the end of a long European season. I mean, the European season is still ongoing. The UEFA Champions League final hasn't been played yet. So a lot of these players are going to be tired. It's going to be very difficult conditions for them. It should suit the Asian teams a little bit better. But even having said that, I think France have so much talent in depth that it's hard to look past them. England, I'd love to see it happen. I just don't think they quite have the same level of talent. They've got 2 or 3 really good players, but do they really have what it takes to go all the way? I think that'd be lucky. Then maybe Brazil, Argentina can maybe take advantage of the fact that it's in the it's in the Western Hemisphere, and that may help them a little bit. But I think France are the favourites for me.
Gio, beyond those obvious favourites, is there a dark horse that you're watching out for? And give us your pick for Golden Boot.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well,
I'm putting you on the spot today.
I was going to say Erling Haaland for Golden Boot. And because of his presence, he's just an inevitable striker for Norway. So I think they might be one of the dark horses. Although they're in a very tough group. They're in with France and Senegal and Iraq. So that's a really tough group. You know, two top 15 teams in France and Senegal, and Iraq obviously can be pesky against anybody. So, but I mean, I'm thinking Norway might surprise some people. Japan, probably the strongest team out of Asia. They're in the group with the Dutch team, Tunisia and Sweden. This is also not an easy group, but I think they're good enough to come out of that group and then go deeper potentially into this tournament than the last time. And someone like Ecuador, Colombia, I think they might fancy a deep also trip to the knockouts at this year's tournament.
Lots of dark horses, Shreya. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, it's 48 nations, right?
So. Yeah, lots to choose from. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's all that we have time for today. Of course, a big thank you, as always, to you, Jihyo, of Yonhap News Agency, here today in the studio. Thanks so much, Jihyo.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And on the line, John Dorden of The Guardian and BBC in England. So great to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index spiked 324.24 points, or 4.32% on Monday, to close at 7,822.24. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ slid 0.38 points, or 0.03%, to close at 1,207.34. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr. Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, what's our first story for today?
Many airline companies in South Korea are working to find ways to cut corners as they struggle to cope with jet fuel price surge caused by the Middle East conflict.
And what were some of these new cost-cutting measures that have been unveiled by these airlines?
So fuel costs account for roughly 30% of an airline's total expenses, so this is a very big issue there. According to industry sources on Monday, airlines are frantically searching for ways to offset mounting losses from the jet fuel price spike. So it's not just domestic budget airlines, but even full-service airliners are looking into measures. The most prominent one includes cutting the number of flights or reducing the number of routes.
Right. I mean, reducing flight routes and services kind of feels like an inevitable option for many airliners at this point. Tell us a bit more on this front.
Asian Airlines, a full-service carrier, is reducing the number of flights from Incheon to Cambodia's Phnom Penh and China's Changchun and Yanji, to name a few. Suspended some long-haul routes to Kazakhstan's Almaty as well as Istanbul. Budget carriers are doing the same in the case of Jin Air. It cut 131 round-trip flights across 14 routes, including to Cebu.
And what about other measures under review or being implemented to try and help ease this financial pressure?
Some airliners, including Tiwei, are set to lower baggage limits and increase fees for excessive luggage. There are also other firms considering sending cabin crew on unpaid leave and indefinitely postponing bonuses. Officials will likely seek ways to further expand ancillary revenue, and improve aircraft and crew utilization.
Right, let's move on to our next story now.
British pop star Dua Lipa has filed a $15 million lawsuit against Korea's Samsung Electronics.
Okay, give us the details of this lawsuit.
She is suing them for allegedly benefiting from the use of her image on an advertisement without her permission. Dua Lipa first became aware of Samsung's alleged use of her image last summer. According to her lawyers, Samsung used her image on boxes for their new television set.
And Daniel, give us more details. How exactly did this come about?
So her legal team mentioned that Samsung declined her request to stop using her picture on the ads. The image in question is one of the pop singer from 2024 at the Austin City Limits Music Festival in Texas. Dua Lipa owns the rights to the image, therefore making it legal to use it without her permission. On this basis, she is suing Samsung for copyright, trademark, and publicity rights infringement.
And just how much of an impact would using the star's image influence have on the sales of things like Samsung's television sets?
Well, Dua Lipa's lawyers included in the filing against Samsung screenshots from customers expressing enthusiasm for the television set because of Dua Lipa's image on it. Various surveys and studies shows the degree of impact celebrity endorsement have in sales, and when it involves a globally renowned pop star of her caliber, that effect can be significantly higher. We will have to see how the suit turns out.
Absolutely. And we'll have to, of course, watch whether this becomes a broader warning for companies using other stars and star power in their marketing. Let's now turn to our final story of the day.
The popularity of Korean language classes offered in schools around the world continues to rise. In fact, more than 50% spike in the number of schools overseas providing such courses in less than half a decade.
I can't say I'm surprised at all. I think these figures clearly reflect the rapidly growing popularity of the Hallyu way, of the Korean wave, and of Korean classes in schools overseas. Daniel, can you give us a deeper dive, though, into those related figures?
Sure thing. The Education Ministry shared on Sunday data that covers overseas primary and secondary schools that offer Korean either as part of their regular curriculum or through after-school programs. As of the end of 2025, more than 2,700 overseas schools were operating Korean language classes. The number has been increasing annually every year since 2021, spiking by some 64% compared to the 2021 figures.
And what were some of the key contributing factors to this trend?
Education Ministry officials pointed to growing popularity of K-pop and K-culture as a driving force, of course. But interest in Korea leading to more foreigners visiting Korea or moving to study in Korea, growing Korean governmental support for such educational facilities and programs overseas over the years definitely contributed, including financial assistance for program operations, textbook distribution, and teacher training initiatives for local educators. And also, strong promotional efforts cannot be denied. They were conducted by Korean educational establishments in various foreign countries.
And of course, what comes next? What's the next step to ensure that the popularity of Korean language classes overseas continues to grow?
All these efforts cost money. The budget for a government-funded program supporting Korean language education in overseas primary and secondary schools have been raised again this year after seeing a slight cut in 2025. Back in March, Education Minister Choi Kyo-jin pledged expanded support for Korean language education during his visits to Vietnam and the Philippines, where a strong interest in Korean culture has led to high demand for Korean language education. Officials will also need to devise country-specific support and promotional activities from here on, since while large increases in schools were noted in countries like Uzbekistan, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, and the Philippines, countries such as Czech Republic, Italy, Norway, Georgia, Ethiopia, and Turkmenistan had only one school offering Korean classes.
Well, it's wonderful to see that interest continuing to grow, and long may it last. That's where we'll wrap up today's edition of Korea Trending. Daniel, thanks so much for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, my name is Anna Yates Liu, assistant professor from the Department of Korean Music at Seoul National University. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
It's now time for our weekly sports roundup. But because Yoo Ji-ho, our regular contributor, just appeared on our in-depth, we've invited a special guest for the segment. However, we are continuing the football theme and digging into the domestic K-League. Paju Frontier FC are making history this season. After beginning as a citizen football club in Korea's 5th division, Paju have now completed a remarkable climb to the professional stage, making their K-League 2 debut this year, the first club in Korean football history to take that path. And leading the team into this new chapter is Spanish head coach Gerard Nuss, whose coaching career has taken him from the Liverpool FC Academy in England to the Greece men's national team. Despite being newcomers to the professional ranks, Paju are already turning heads, sitting in the top half of the table and proving they are not just here to make up the numbers. We're speaking with the man guiding Paju through their first season as a professional club. Head coach Gerard Nuss joins us now on the line. Coach Nuss, welcome to Korea 24.
Hello, thank you very much. For me, it's a pleasure to be here, to be invited. Great honor.
The honor is all ours, Coach Nuss. And actually, before we jump in, you've had a history with Korean football going back to 2011 when you spent a year on the coaching staff at Jeonnam Dragons. Fast forward 15 years, you're back in the K-League, this time as the head coach. I understand it's been about 4 months since you arrived back in Korea. I have to ask you, what's your experience been like so far, and how are you acclimating?
Well, the acclimation in Korea, it's very easy, at least for me, because it's a very nice place with a very nice people, enthusiastic people for football, and very welcoming. So I didn't have any issues, any problems. I can only say positive things. Obviously, in terms of the project, it's not exactly the same that when I came here 14 years ago, because it's a different club, it's a different location. But I see also the generations that they they're changing a lot everywhere in the world. So different mentalities, more open-minded, and the same positive things that I breathed and I felt years ago when I was here, which is people that want to get better, people that, that's my players, the staff, everybody around us, you know, making Baggio Frontier a better club every day. So I'm very excited for the present.
And what motivated you to come back to South Korea and take the helm of a football club here?
Well, first, because I had a good memory from my year here. Second, when I met the management, the ownership, I saw everyone very, very enthusiastic about this project. And I like to be in a place that I have the feeling that I can help it, that I can make it a better organization. And I always repeated the same. For me, a football coach, especially in this project, is not just someone focused on the things happening in the pitch, also outside the pitch, because at the end of the day, we want to perform in the ground, we want to win games, but we want to get better players, we want to improve the current players, and we want to become a more effective organization. So it's you know, very, very busy time. But we are, in the short time that we have been here, we've done very serious steps to become, in the years ahead, hopefully a very serious and promising club in the country.
Mm-hmm. But beyond returning to Korea, this is also a very specific kind of challenge, leading a club in its first professional season. Paju Frontier FC made their K-League 2 debut this year, and you're the club's first head coach at this now professional level. Just some context for our listeners. You've worked with national teams before, including the Greek men's national team and Ghana's national team, where, of course, the focus is often on short camps, tournaments and immediate results. At Paju, as you mentioned, you're building a club, you know, week by week in its very first professional season. Did the fact that Paju is a rookie team affect your decision in any way to lead the team?
No, not really. I don't think. It's when you analyze the options or the offers, that when you are in the football business, you take into consideration many things, not just one thing or two or three. You need to see the timings, you need to see the people involved, you need to put many things into consideration. So I wouldn't say it's just one reason. I think it was many, many things that make it this project very, very attractive, very, very positive one. And I did not regret it for a single time. My decision is proving me every day a correct one. I'm enjoying my time here. We don't have too much time to enjoy it outside football, to be honest. But for myself, for my coaching staff, we have the enjoyment and the satisfaction of seeing in every day how the team is getting better, how the players, they're improving their level, how everybody here with our limited resources and limited budget, we are capable of facing great opponents, great clubs, historical teams, and how we are not that far behind. I would even say that probably we could beat pretty much everyone. We're having a decent fights in all the games, even the ones that we didn't get the result that we wanted. So far, many, many positive things.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of other teams and the league itself, the level Paju now has to compete at week after week has changed. You first worked in Korean football, as we've talked about, more than a decade ago. Looking at the K-League 2 now, how would you assess the level of competition? And how has Korean football changed in any noticeable ways since your time with the Jeonnam Dragons?
Well, it's very competitive, K1, K2. Probably K2 it's more physical than K1. I think every game you can see that both teams could win. You know, they could take something. So that makes the league very, very exciting. That's how teams like us, that we are new in the competition, also we can have chances against everyone. But obviously there are some clubs that, in my opinion, they are more close to being K1 than others. Probably, if you see the current table already, put some of the most clear candidates to be on K1 next year. Exception maybe Daegu, which in my opinion is a club that should be on the top positions, but the rest are the expected ones. Then there is other group of teams competing to get into the playoff, to get into the six, and maybe some other teams trying to get away from the bottom positions. But it's still early in the competition, so I think we need to see. It's long during a season. Pretty much all teams have bad moments, so it's important to manage those timings in the best way possible. And when you have the positive run of results, take it as much as possible, and hopefully you can make it last for as much as possible. So this is things that happens in football. The dynamics, the momentums, those timings are very, very crucial, very important.
As you said, coaches, it still is early days. It's been about just 2 months since the season kicked off in late February. But I am going to ask you, how do you assess Padu's performance so far?
Well, I try to analyze it not just from winning or losing or drawing, because that's too easy to analyze it from that point of view. It's too simplistic as well. So we try to say since day one that when we play our first opener game against Von Samsung, we lost 0-1, but we had the chance. We could get a point from that game. And I would say pretty much from all games, we were very close, you know, to get points. And obviously we achieved 4 victories so far. You know, it's very positive, and probably nobody or not many people expected that from us. So it's been a decent and a positive start, but we want more. We are very ambitious. That's how it comes in our nature. I didn't come here for vacation. I came here to really help, you know, the players that we got right now, to make it a better organization, and I think we've proven it. But we don't want to stop here. We still want more. So now what we are very, very focused is in the next game, next opponent. We want to do our best game. We respect everyone. Everyone can get points, can get wins, but with the full respect that we give to the opponents, we're going to do whatever we can to make it very difficult for them to take points from our stadium.
Mm-hmm. And coach, could you tell us about your coaching style? What do you like to emphasize with your players and the team the most?
That's very, very good question. Look, at the end of the day, in the professional football, you need to get results. The first thing we analyze here is what players we got. What are the characteristics of the players? Some other coaches might decide different. They might decide, okay, I want to play that style, so I made the players to do that. So here what we try to do is, what is the skill already of the player? What is in his nature? So from there, we try to improve it a little bit, and we try to reduce the things that might expose him. So basically, we try to get advantage of our strength, and obviously we try to limit or to reduce our weaknesses. And we try to do the same things from the opponent. So we analyze the opponent, and even we have kind of identity in ourselves. But we need to consider what is the strength of that teams, and we have to adapt sometimes to make it less dangerous. So this is our combination. I think that if you are one of the top teams in the league, in any league in the world, the other teams have to adapt more to yourself. In this case, where we are, I think we have to say these are things that you cannot negotiate. You have to stick to these points because already gave us good results, which we are a good competitive team. We're a team that knows how to attack. We are a team that knows how to defend. We have to improve, obviously, as a team. We have to improve individual things. This is a process. It takes time. Every week, every training is an opportunity to get better. But this is how you build a series of structure. You need to, that it is determination, these clear points, this time as well, and this consistency. Mm-hmm. So we are in the good track. We are in a good direction. Now we just need to keep pushing, keep going forward.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of direction and going forward, looking ahead, as we've touched on, of course, this first season will be an important marker for the club, not just in terms of results, but in, I think, setting expectations for what Padua can become. What would you say would make this season a success for you, and what goals have you set for the team?
Well, if you are truly honest, at the beginning, when you start the season, you could say any new club in the division, that it's been new and it's been just created, you would think, okay, if they survive and they stay in the league, should be good enough, right? This is what any of the three clubs new in the K2 should think, in my opinion. This would be the logical thing. But what happened here is that we have a coaching staff, a group of players, everyone involved, that, as I said, and I use this word already, we want to do better and better every day. And it's not just something that sounds nice or good to hear or to say, it's a meaning. So that's why we put so many hours into the, because for us it's not just a job, it's our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you put too much and you put it everything there, you're expecting, you know, to get not just okay results. And I cannot come and now and say, if we finish in that position, it means good. If we finish in that position, it doesn't mean that it's not good. But I can tell you that we try to get to win as much as possible. We try to do all we can to give good satisfaction to our fans when they come to the stadiums. And yes, that's how we are. You know, it's first thing for any club, as I said, should be to avoid relegation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, second, all you can do to push and to get the team as forward and higher position as better. And then every week will tell us where actually we deserve to be. And then we assess and we move on.
Finally, Coach News, before we let you go, a word for the people following this new chapter for Padua. Do you have any brief message for our listeners and for Padua Frontier FC fans who are supporting the team in its first professional season?
I always said the football team without the fans means nothing. So we do that for them. We want and we need them as well, because if we are, you know, many people supporting coming to the stadiums, we have the advantage to be, you know, 11 players. We could be 12 players. So we need them. If you come to our office, you would see photos of our victory celebrations. So I want to see more of those moments, because it's a beautiful time. And obviously the fans are on those photos. So that tells you how important it is the fans to join us, to feel happy of the club, feel a proper citizen, you know, and a football team is a way to express it, is a way to support, to feel proud and happy of where you live, your life in this amazing city in the north of the country. So, yes, hopefully they feel excited already, but hopefully we're going to be more and more happy together in the future. So I welcome them, because we need them, because we are better with them.
I think that's the perfect note to end our conversation on today. Coach Gerard News, thank you so much for joining us on Korea 24. We wish you and the club the very, very best for the rest of the season.
Thank you very much. As I said, a pleasure to be invited here, and anytime we will be very happy to talk again. So thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. Don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. We've got more stories, interviews and insights you won't want to miss. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thanks for joining me. Take care and goodbye.
Did you know that Korea 24 is active on social media? You can do more than just listen to Korea 24. You can find out what the team has been up to on Korea 24's social media accounts. We are on Instagram on KBS_Korea24, where we post about our weekly segments from Monday's sports segment to Friday's movie spotlight. Sometimes we share snippets of the team's day behind the scenes so you can get to know us better. On YouTube, we upload filmed versions of our segments, and you can also check out what other language services have been up to. Find us on @KBS World Radio Service. Make the most of your Korea 24 experience by following us on social media.
KBS World Radio.